What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Frank Spotnitz. Frank is a screenwriter and executive producer best known for his work on The X-Files and The Man in the High Castle. Spotnitz is also the CEO and founder of Big Light Productions, a London and Paris-based production company which specializes in international television series, including drama, comedy, and documentaries. Spotnitz's career includes creating, writing, and producing series with networks, cable, streaming, and other broadcast platforms around the world. Under the Big Light banner, Spotnitz has produced Amazon's Emmy-winning The Man of the High Castle, Medici, Masters of Florence, and two seasons of Medici the Magnificent, along with many others. And now I give you Frank Spotnitz. Okay, I'm here with Frank Spotnitz. Frank, thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Really interested in tracking through your career, how you brushed with what we might call television history. But before we do that, please tell listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
So I'm Frank Spotnitz. I'm a writer and producer, an American, as you can hear from my accent, but I've been living in Europe, in London and Paris for the last 13 years now. But I began my career as a journalist, actually. And then my first job in television was The X-Files, which was a really good first job to have. And I ended up doing several series with Chris Carter, who created that show. I did Millennium and Harsh Realm and The Lone Gunman and two X-Files movies with Chris. And then I've done a bunch of other television series since then.
Perfect. Thanks, Frank. And yeah, I plan on tracking through most, if not all, of that. You will know this because we actually just spoke before I hit record here that I recently released an interview that I did with the great Nicholas Meyer, who I know you know well. I'd love to ask you where you first met Nick and what his work has meant to you, if anything.
That's such a great question. I love Nicholas Meyer. And I first met him, I believe it was in 2007. Because a producer friend of mine had an idea to turn The 7% Solution, which is one of his great Sherlock Holmes novels and a great film as well, into a TV series. And we were unsuccessful because at the time, Universal, which owns the rights outright, said Sherlock Holmes is over. Nobody's doing Sherlock Holmes anymore. It's course. Cut to, a few years later, Benedict Cumberbatch and Robert Downey Jr. and so on. But we remained friends after that, and we've collaborated on many projects since then, including notably the Medici TV series that's on Netflix.
Wonderful. So rolling the clock back a little bit, Frank, I'd love to know, when did you become interested in writing and how did you foster a career in it?
So as a child, I was an indiscriminate viewer of all television. I watched hours, endless hours of television. My parents never stopped me. And I was particularly taken, I'd say, with Star Trek, the original Star Trek, and The Twilight Zone, but other shows too. Mission Impossible was really important to me. Wild Wild West was important to me. Man from U.N.C.L.E., I could go on and on. And movies. I would go to the movies and I would sit and watch the same movie two or three times in a row. And I always knew I wanted to be in the movie or TV business. And I went to UCLA to study. Okay, I was in Arizona mostly as a kid, and I went to UCLA to study film and television. And then I had a death in my family that really threw me for a loop, and I kind of lost my way, to be honest. And at the same time, I had a class in journalism, and I ended up turning toward journalism, becoming editor of the paper, and working as a reporter for 7 years, until I finally got to the point in my late 20s where I just said, I can't do this the rest of my life. I need to go back. And so at the age of 29, I went to film school, the American Film Institute in Los Angeles. And then fortunately for me, my first job out of film school was The X-Files, which was a second film school for me. But, you asked earlier about Nick Meyer and his influence on me. And I realized when I met Nick, part of the reason we got on so well was because he had influenced me. Because he told the types of stories that I like to tell. And I think if I look at Nick, who obviously, not coincidentally directed the greatest Star Trek movie ever made, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, or The Twilight Zone. Nick tells stories that are deeply entertaining, but also very smart and about something. There's a reason to tell these stories. They make you think. You think about them long after they're over. And that's exactly the kind of television movies I love and the kind of stories that I've tried to tell in my career.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Frank. So I'm really curious about asking you about pitching an idea and what that experience is like. I would imagine be quite nerve-wracking. And then maybe a corollary question on that, how you deal with rejection, as I'm sure you have.
Oh, my God. I rejected all the time. People wouldn't believe it. You have to have such a thick skin in this business. And it's salted all that. It's like, oh, my God, did they just say that to me? And you just have to let it go. But, you know, I say you have to have an appropriate ego in this business. You have to really love what you're doing and really believe in it. You're asking people to invest in it, to spend their time, part of their stock and career stock and something you're doing. So you need to really love it and work hard and deliver your best. And then when people come at you with criticism or rejection, you set aside that big fat ego and you let it in, especially if what they're saying could make what you're doing better or if you can learn something from it. You need to have that ability to switch your ego, you know, on and off, let it in and take it away when necessary. But I've always enjoyed pitching because I tend to overprepare. I tend to like do far more work than you need to do for my pitch because I want to make sure I know what I'm talking about. But I love the show and I want to communicate my passion for the show and get the people I'm pitching to as excited about it as I am. So for me, it's never been something that I dread. I do less of it now than I used to because Los Angeles is a verbal pitching culture and being here in Europe is not. It tends to be more of a written pitch, but I would much rather sit here talking like I am to you than write it down.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, here, I'm going to roll the dice and I'm going to try and quote you from another interview and let's see where it takes us.
Okay.
You said in an interview with the BBC some years ago that you strive to, quote you, to make character and story inseparable.
Yeah.
Awesome. Would you be able to elaborate on that, Frank?
Yeah, I think when I started out as a writer, I was better at plot. Right. And plot is sort of like, it's the construction, you know, you do this, it's the carpentry of writing. And that's one thing I tell writers is you will get better at this, the craft elements of writing. You do it again and again and again, you get stronger at that. It's like going to the gym every day, you know, and you start to build the craft part. But really that means nothing without the art, without the emotion, without the characters, right? The human beings that occupy your story. That is what moves people. You know, you see yourself in those people. They're not you, but it's your chance to look at the world through somebody else's eyes. And so the perfect story in my mind is a marriage of plot and character. You can't pull them apart because you've selected these events to happen to this person. It could only happen to this person this way, right? Like Vince's show, Breaking Bad, I think is a perfect illustration of that, right? Mm-hmm. That story is about Walter White, who in my mind felt like a little man. He's on his 40th birthday. He's got this cancer diagnosis. You know, he's not respected by the kids at his school.
Trying to get by.
Die broke. Yeah. And he can't accept that. Even after his cancer goes into remission, he realizes he wants to be a big man and that he fights ever bigger obstacles to become a big man, you know, which is why I think we rooted for him, even though he was a bad guy, right? And those doing bad things. So I always do think about, you know, am I plotting something? Is this just plot? Is this just machinery that could happen to anybody? Or is it designed for the character that I'm telling the story about? And is it interesting, particularly to see how this person will react to this obstacle?
Yeah. No, that's incredible, Frank. Thank you. That makes a lot of sense to me. You know, we were talking rejection a few minutes ago, Frank. And being a writer, obviously, you do deal with a lot of rejection. You know, I wonder if perhaps some imposter syndrome kicks in at some point. And this might be an odd question, but when did you feel comfortable calling yourself a writer?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I don't have imposter syndrome only because I think, like Vince, I'm genuinely humble. I don't have a big ego. I really don't. So I know my own shortcomings and limitations, but I also know my strengths, you know. So, but I think the hardest part of my career was before I got paid. That period before X-Files, when I was writing scripts that nobody was making or buying. And I was trying to motivate myself to get up in the morning and sit at my, you know, my laptop and write. Nobody was calling me a writer. Nobody was giving me any validation. There were no deadlines. And then, honestly, it probably took me a few years in The X-Files before I began to feel like I really was a writer. But I have to say, I have never stopped learning. And I think I understand more about what I'm doing now than I did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I lean into my work and I really care and do my best. And I think if you do that, this is such a rewarding career, because writing is one of those things you will never master. It doesn't matter who you are. You could be Aaron Sorkin. You can be, you know, name any writer, you, Quentin Tarantino, whoever you are, the most talented writer you can imagine, they still could fail, right? Because it's too many variables to this. It's too complex. And every time out, you're telling a new story. So it's a completely different set of problems. If you're doing it right, it's a completely different set of problems. There are no stock answers to anything, which means you could screw it up. And so if you lean into that challenge and you accept it and you're aware of it, every day is exciting because you are fully engaged and using everything you have intellectually, emotionally, intuitively, you're bringing it to your work. That's why I tell people, like, if you want to do this, do it. You know, don't be afraid. Fear is the most corrosive thing, and lean in and do it. And you'll find out, you know, after a few years, if you haven't been rewarded with success, if nobody's recognized your talent, you're going to start to go, maybe I don't love this enough to stick with it, you know, but maybe you will, you know, and give yourself a chance to fail or succeed and be patient with yourself and be kind, because nobody's good in the beginning. You know, Vince was awfully good in the beginning, but even Vince, you know, as a young man, had things to learn. And most of us, it takes us a while to get up to a level that we think is good enough. You know, you watch all these things on TV and movies, and they're amazing, right? And you could be super critical. Like, I could watch a Martin Scorsese movie, right? One of the great living directors. And I could tell you 20 things that are wrong with it, but could I make that movie? Could I do what Martin Scorsese does, right? That's the frustration about this, is trying to be as good as the work that you see, but that's the right kind of frustration. You know, you don't want to be the kind of writer that goes, well, that's good enough. Oh, well, it's better than that. It's better than that crappy show. It's like, well, but you're not here to make crappy shows. You're here to do the best shows ever, right? And keep that in mind. It's a great career.
Absolutely. Well said, Frank. Thank you. I know there's an interesting story about how you became involved in The X-Files. Didn't it have something to do with, you weren't thinking about yourself for the position at first, correct?
Yeah, it's completely true. I was not that clever, Joshua, because I had been in a book group before The X-Files was ever on with a guy named Chris Carter. And I was in the book group for a couple of years, and I would see him, you know, every couple months. We read different books. The theme of the book group was books you should have read in college but didn't. So they were all classics. The book group ends, and I don't see Chris anymore. And then one night after I graduated from film school, I see on television The X-Files created by Chris Carter. And it happened to be the pilot episode. So I watched the whole show. That was great. But it never occurs to me to call him or ask for a job. I'm like trying to make it, but it never crosses my mind. And then a friend of mine, whom I'd grown up with in Phoenix, was also in LA trying to make it as a screenwriter. And he called me toward the end of the first season and said, don't you know this guy, Chris Carter? I said, yeah, we were in a book group. He goes, will you call him for me and see if I can pitch him some ideas? And so I feel very awkward about this, but had known this guy a long time. So I call Chris and he says, no, I will not hear your friend's ideas. But if you have any ideas, I'll hear yours. And I did. I thought of three ideas. I went in to pitch them, didn't buy any of them. And I thought, well, that was a waste of time and kind of embarrassing. But then a few weeks later, as I recall, he called me and said, I didn't buy any of them, but they were all good. This is what was good about this and this and this and this. Look, I don't want to buy a script from you freelance. Why don't you come on staff? Because we're losing two writers. So I look back on the staff, Joshua, and if you know anything about The X-Files, the two writers he was losing were Glenn Morgan and Jim Wong, the two greatest writers on the show.
Yep.
And he replaces them with me, just out of film school, no credit whatsoever. So he was a pretty demanding boss. It was a very competitive environment. And I was so green and so naive about so many things. And I honestly needed time to kind of grow into the job. But he saw something in me right away. And it was exactly the right show for me. It was exactly what I would have loved as a kid, you know, having watched Star Trek and Twilight Zone. And I got it. I did get it. You know, I was green, but I understood the core of the show. And I think I proved my value in the writer's room and editing. And within 3 years, I went from staff writer, which is the very bottom, to executive producer, which is the very highest you can go in American television. So it was a happy story. I got there, you know, I got there a little late, but I did get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Carter, if I don't miss my mark, is known for being somewhat demanding. I think you said in another interview that writers didn't tend to last very long for what I'm sure is a myriad of reasons. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about working with him, what that dynamic was like, and perhaps what you learned from him.
I think the best things about Chris were his sort of ruthless intelligence and his incredible ambition. I mean, it could not be good enough. And he demanded everybody give their best. And it wasn't enough for you to leave at 6 or 7 in the evening. You're going to leave at 9 or 10 or 11 at night. And so it really, I say, it chewed up my personal life for 8 years. I mean, I just lived and breathed the X-Files. And there was an episode, I think it's season 7, called Milagro, about a writer who's obsessed with Agent Scully. And that was me, because I realized I spent more time thinking about these two fictitious characters than any real person in my life. That's how devoted I was to the show. But that's what Chris demanded. And I think that's why, you know, Vince Gilligan and Glenn Morgan and Jim Long and John Scheibman and Howard Gordon and Alex Gonza and all these amazing writers did such brilliant work on that show and continue to do brilliant work afterwards, is because Chris insisted. And it wasn't always fun. It was certainly stressful. It's a very hard show. I mean, you know, trying to come up with a new monster or, you know, supernatural phenomenon every week, 24 times a year, you know, and that show ran 9 seasons, not counting the reboot.
Right.
It's, and without repeating yourself, you know, and I think the thing I'm proudest of, I don't think every episode was great. You know, I won't tell you the ones I don't like, but there are several I don't like, but I know we tried our hardest, you know, the entire time we did the best we were capable of. And I owe that to Chris. You know, I think about the lessons he taught me, you know, every day to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I suspect there's no real answer to this as such, but I'd love to know, what was your process for thinking through how to write for X-Files? You know, you just mentioned a minute ago a bit about like the structure, what would have to be floating in your mind. I suppose what inspired you to create the monster for next week or the dialogue, etc.? That question makes sense?
Yeah, totally. I always thought about what scared me as a child or what fascinated me, you know, just to kind of get to that sort of primal level. And so, you know, the whole black oil, you know, the idea of black oil in your eye, I found that very disturbing. Or, you know, one of my early standalone episodes was about cannibalism. And I went to the UCLA library to research it. This was before the internet. And all the books on cannibalism, the pages were torn out. And I realized I'm onto something. Like, they're tearing the pages out of the library books. People are definitely interested in this. It wasn't an intellectual thing. It was like a visceral thing. What disturbed me? What bothered me? There's another episode later on where somebody was talking about a bad dream where they squeezed a toothpaste tube and blood came out. That's a really disturbing image. And then I would build the story from there. And sometimes they're just scenes you had or moments, and you sort of start to connect them, you know, through a narrative. As the show went on, though, I'd say by the 4th season, so my 3rd year on the show, I started to realize that the best episodes were the episodes that actually were about something, that you knew why you were telling the story. You understood what this monster or supernatural phenomena meant or represented. Because I began to sort of consciously understand that when you're telling stories about the supernatural or science fiction, they're really about the world we're in today, you know, and monsters are simply an exaggeration of something about real people that terrifies us. And I didn't always know why I was telling the story, but I then learned to look for that reason. And I think it increased my batting average in terms of, you know, successful storytelling, having that tool in my kit.
Yeah, no, extraordinary. Thank you, Frank. That makes sense to me. I can never forgive myself if I didn't ask what it was like working for Vince Gilligan. I mean, just to maybe a quick note for our listeners, that name sounds familiar. He, of course, would go on to create Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. But yes, what was it like working with Vince?
So Vince is one of the nicest people in the world. And success, his massive success, has not changed him one bit. He's still the same person I met 25 years ago. Absolutely lovely guy, totally genuine, very humble and modest, still is. I think he was a genius always. I think, you know, he was bored out of his mind in Virginia, literally shooting tin cans, you know, on his fence posts, waiting for movies to get made that never got made. And he watched The X-Files and liked it. And then against the advice of his agents, he wrote a script on spec that became Soft Light, and it's a 2nd season episode. And nobody outside the X-Files staff could ever do that. You know, he came so close to actually capturing the show without having been in the room or breaking the story on his own. And so then he joined the staff the year after me in the third season. And I just, you know, you couldn't help but love him. He's a great guy and so talented. And I think in the beginning, structure wasn't his thing. Obviously, he has structure, you know, backwards and forwards now. But his writing on the page was so inventive and clever and funny. And he has certain turns of phrase, Vince, that I recognize. You know, I can just tell that's his voice. So, you know, I think he's one of the great, great talents we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that something a writer should strive for? You mentioned sort of having his signature style. You can almost see his trademark at the end of the sentence, right?
Yeah.
Do you think it's good for a writer to have that sort of style, or should they be more non-signature?
I think it's great if it's who you are, if it's naturally who you are. I don't think it's something you can sort of decide you're going to do, you know, if you don't have it in you. Like, I don't think I have that. You know, I don't think that's my strength. I think your job as a writer or any creative person is to find whatever it is you have inside, whatever's in your soul and your heart and your spirit, and try to bring it to the page or to the canvas or to the recording studio, whatever you're doing, because that's the one thing you have that nobody else has is you. You know, your point of view, what moves you, what makes you laugh, what makes you cry. And that's why people want to see movies and TV shows and read novels and, you know, any story. You want to be inside somebody else's head. And so the more you can access what it is you have, wherever you are, the more powerful your storytelling will be. I've been teaching writing for the last 10 years in Berlin at a program called Serial Eyes. And I say to people, you know, I really think 90-95% of this is effort. It's work ethic. It's persistence. It's sticking with it. It's getting up every day and doing your best. Some of it's talent, but most of it is that. Mm-hmm. And I think you work so hard to polish whatever that thing is, to make it gleam so that it shines so brightly that people don't notice the 25 other things you cannot do. That's like nobody can do it. Like Alfred Hitchcock, one of my all-time favorite directors.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant suspense. Right? That's the thing he was great at. He probably couldn't have done a musical. He probably, you know, but I don't care. He just leaned into his skill so profoundly that he's a master. You know, some people are masters of dialogue. Some people are masters at suspense or romance or whatever it is that's inside you. Try to tap into that and do your best.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you, Frank. What is Big Light Productions?
So I came to London with my family 13 years ago to do a show for the BBC and Cinemax called Hunted. And after 2 years, the show ended and nobody in my family wanted to move back to Los Angeles. Everybody wanted to stay here. And I won't bore you with what a radically different TV culture this is to the one that I knew in Hollywood, but it is radically different. And the only way I could figure out to stay here was to start my own company. So I started Big Light Productions 10 years ago this year as a way to employ myself and others and work the way I wanted to work. And so it's an independent production company based in London, and we do shows with all kinds of writers. Now, most of our slate are things that I'm not even writing now. So I'm a producer first and a writer second, although I'm extremely busy as a writer as well. And we've worked with all kinds of writers in the UK, American writers, Canadian writers, Italian writers, French writers. And we do shows, you know, in Europe, in Canada, in the US, in the UK. And I think, you know, those values I talked about learning on the X-Files about sort of ruthless intelligence and extreme ambition, I think we still carry those values, you know, at Big Light, and that do shows that are entertaining that, you know, you'll be glad you watched after they're open.
Wonderful. One show that I really loved was The Man in the High Castle, which Big Light produced, and you're credited as the creator, with all due respect, of course, given to Philip K. Dick, who wrote the book the show is based on. How did you get the idea for the show, Frank?
So this is the truth. I read that book when I was in college and it blew my mind. I never forgot that. Oh my God, what if the world had taken another path? What if the good guys lost? It's really scary. And you go, that, you know, it was the first time it struck me that, you know, it's not inevitable. Good guys are going to win, right?
Right.
So the show Hunted ended. I'm here in London and this guy, David Zucker from Ridley Scott's company, still the head of Ridley Scott's TV company, calls me and says, hey, you ever read The Man in the High Castle? Would you like to adapt it? Like, oh my God, yes, I love that book. I read it in college. He goes, well, we've been trying to crack this thing for years. We've had so many scripts. We've never been able to crack it. We had one last chance. Would you like to do it? I said, yes. So I make the deal. And then I went back and I read the book for the first time since college. And it's a brilliant book, but it has no narrative. It is no plot. And I later discovered that Philip K. Dick read it. I wrote it while playing the I Ching. You know, it was sort of like he would just let the I Ching tell him what to write next, what should happen next to the story. And so I was really stuck with this terrible problem about how to adapt this book and be true to the great Philip K. Dick. You know, I didn't want to mess up his work, but I also knew that making a TV series that wasn't a TV series wasn't going to honor him either.
Right.
So I identified for myself, learning what I'd learned from The X-Files, what are the themes of this? And I decided that themes of it, there were several, but the most important ones were, how do you maintain your humanity in an inhumane world? And if you're living in a fascist society, how do you do the right thing? And then another one was, what's the nature of reality itself, right? Which is mind-bending. And so then I took those themes and I took the characters and I kind of juggled them and I added new characters. The John Smith character played by Rufus Sewell wasn't in the novel at all. And I was still really nervous that people were going to think I'd messed up Philip K. Dick. And then it came out and everybody was like, look how faithful he was to Philip K. Dick. And I, okay, good. I didn't screw it up then because it feels like Philip K. Dick. And I think that was my goal. Yeah. That was really important to me, to honor him, because I do think he was a genius and a visionary, and so many of his stories prove that. And I'd like to think he would have been proud of what I did with the show.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I loved it. And it's funny you mentioned Rufus Sewell, the vastly underrated, in my opinion, actor. Great actor.
He's one of the great living actors. He is.
I agree. Certainly in Man in High Castle. To be able to have the ability to make a Nazi, I won't say likable, but empathetic, let's say, you see his humanity. Especially the whole subplot with his son and, you know, getting sick. How did you flesh out his character?
Well, it's interesting because I think having lived in Europe and especially taught in Germany really helped me, because it struck me the contradiction that there are people who in your everyday life, you may like them. They may be good fathers and, you know, husbands, and they may be pleasant work, but they are capable of doing evil things. And I think that most of the Nazis I remember seeing in movies are kind of like cartoon characters, like out of Indiana Jones, you know, which I love those movies, I'm not knocking them, but they're not complex people. And that was one of the core convictions I had in going to the show, is that somebody on a personal level may seem like a nice man or a good man, or, you know, you may enjoy having a deal with them, but they could go to work and put people in an oven, you know, they could execute people. And I do believe that's true. And so that to me was the key to that character, John Smith. And it was funny, Joshua, because I'd written the first two episodes. And when Rufus, he told me when he read the first script, he didn't want to do it, because the first script, he's just a Nazi hunting for Joe Blake. And he tortures the resistance leader that Joe Blake met with before he left New York. Then he read the second script, which one of the early scenes is John Smith sitting with his wife and kids and giving his son sort of a moral lecture, you know, very father knows best kind of lecture, but warped through fascist ideology. So as soon as he read that scene, he goes, oh, I get it. I get what this show is about. And then he was in. And I think through the whole series, even after I left the show, because I left in the middle of season two, I think Rufus was like a guardian of that, the integrity of that character. You know, whenever somebody would come in, a writer or a director, and try and turn him into the Nazis we all know, nope, I'm not doing that. He's evil, but on a personal level, you know, there is that dichotomy that I think we often forget.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the things that made Christoph Waltz's Hans Landa character so compelling, in my opinion, was he was multidimensional. He could be...
That's another great... Yeah.
Yeah.
Another great actor, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Could be likable, could be charming. And as you say, you could see yourself having a beer with him.
Yeah.
I have just a couple questions left, Frank, if that's okay.
No.
We're making good time. So, you know, I'd love to discuss the creative process in general with you, you know, such as it is. In another interview, you said that you write and make movies and books for people who can read. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
What did I mean when I said that? I don't know. I don't know what I meant by that. Yeah, I shouldn't have said that, because it's interesting. I did a show for CBS a few years ago called Ransom, and I was deliberately trying to make it reach a wide audience, not people who read, because it was about a hostage negotiator. And in that show, what was interesting about it was he's trying to stop violence. He fails if a gun is fired. He's trying to like disarm people. And I thought, that's an interesting idea to plant to a wide audience, is that victory is stopping violence. Hard to make that exciting. I think we did. And I remember having dinner with an actor who I love, one of the actors from Man in the High Castle, and talking about this show and how I really wanted to reach middle America. And I was frustrated that I didn't think it was reaching a big enough audience. And he said, oh, don't worry about that audience. Just reach the audience that, you know, is on your side. That's not good enough for me. You know, I'm not satisfied just making shows from people that already agree with me or already see the world I see it. I want to find a way to reach the people that don't agree with me and to, you know, connect to our common humanity. So no, I shouldn't have said that because I don't care whether people read books or not. It'd be lovely if they do.
Yeah.
Fewer people read books now, by the way, than ever, because we all have short attention spans thanks to our phones and iPads and computers.
Yeah. No, I agree with that, Frank. What are you currently working on, Frank?
What am I currently working on? I'm working on a bunch of stuff that I can't say because it's all top secret development that hasn't been announced. But what has been announced is a series about the Nuremberg Nazi trials. I'm very excited about working on that with Constantine Film, German production company, and season 3 of a financial thriller called Devils, Patrick Dempsey. And we just did a podcast for Audible that I'm really proud of with Nicola Coster-Waldau from Game of Thrones called Radio Man. That's on Audible.
Excellent. Frank Spotnitz, how can people find out about you, sir?
I have two websites. I have biglight.com, which is my production company. And then there's my more personal website, which is me, which is frankspotnitz.com, which is just my story and my thoughts on all my work.
Wonderful. Frank, this is a real pleasure, man. Thanks for taking the time for me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for doing such a careful job of researching and being prepared for the interview. You're incredibly well-informed.
Oh,
really a pleasure.
Oh, that makes my day. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you. Thanks, Josh.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.